Julie, today's topic was inspired from a recent patient encounter I had. We always say we learn a ton from patients, and none more than actually our recent episodes where we've had the cancer topics on. Yeah. But I recently had a 16-year-old active boy come in and see me in the office because he was playing touch football in the snow and was pushed onto his back and immediately had pain kind of by his shoulder blade. And he didn't tell anybody about it and didn't really know what to do. And then for about 2 months, basically lived with it until his parents, he brought it up to his parents. His parents looked at it and said, wow, that's swollen and looks really awful. And so then about 2.5 months after it happened, he comes in and sees me. Upon examining him, I noticed that the spine seemed to curve at the level of his shoulder blades, as in like things were sticking out in different ways, but also like your spine wasn't completely straight. And so once you see that, you start to think maybe this is scoliosis, which is kind of leading you maybe where we're going with this episode. And then in addition, I always find, and maybe you have this experience too, but like once you show the parents or the patient, who it's hard for them to see the deformity, they can't believe they never saw it before. It's like almost impossible to unsee it once you see it.
Yeah, and it's always surprising. And it's I feel like I see sometimes the opposite of it, of someone being like, I'm worried that I have scoliosis because there was some weird screening test when I was in grade school that like the nurse did. And then when they told you you had it or you didn't, they're like, well, I don't know. It's your job to take care of it now. Figure it out yourself. And it was just like a weird, like uncomfortable experience because you're already like 12 or 13 years old and you don't want to be like standing in front of some school nurse without a shirt on. And the whole thing is very disempowering and kind of scary and weird. And now it's like, am I deformed? You're telling me I am deformed now? This is bad, right?
Well, it's interesting you say that because it is actually a point that comes up later on in this episode that we'll talk about, that the reason why this is diagnosed a lot at this time is because this is the time where kids don't want to be naked around their parents, is when these things are usually becoming more prominent and easy to diagnose. Again, that is actually a very interesting observation you're making, even though you didn't know you were making it. So we get x-rays on this kid, and he has pretty significant thoracic scoliosis. And as I'm reviewing this with him and his mom, you know, the question that I feel like comes up all the time in the anytime I diagnose scoliosis for the first time is like, how did we not notice this before? How was this just found now?
Yeah, certainly. It sounds like where you were leading me before was like, this kid had an injury, and his injury might be totally unrelated to his scoliosis, but we were looking at his back, and it's like, why are you lumpy? Like, and is this lump, like, where it looks swollen, quote unquote, like, is it a tumor? Is this a bad thing? Why are you crooked? How come I never noticed you were crooked before? Oh no, am I a bad parent? Or like, if you're the kid, like, oh no, do I not know my body? My body's changing that much. And I'm in this age group where it's like, it's already scary enough to be a teenager. And now it's like, now you're crooked. It's awful.
Exactly. So in the same interaction, the mom brought up, she was like, I feel like when I was young, we used to be screened at school, just the way you described it. Like somebody bent down and looked at my back. She was like, do we still do that? And the answer to the question was, I don't know, to be honest. Hence this episode.
Yay.
All this inspired me to dedicate this week to scoliosis. Specifically, I want us to leave this episode knowing how to identify scoliosis and what to do about it. But I also want to explore the experience of living with scoliosis and what treatments and support exist for people who have the diagnosis. One of the things that we've been able to do more recently with this show is bring in the perspective of also the patient and the advocate. And so we're going to continue that trend today. So, Julie, are you ready to navigate the twists and turns of a growing spine?
I certainly am, Jeremy.
Welcome to Your Doctor Friends, the show that teaches you to sniff out the garbage and answers all the questions that you wish you could call or text your doctor friend. My name's Julie Bruni.
And I'm Jeremy Allen, and we are two physicians who work at a nationally ranked practice and take care of some of the world's greatest athletes. We know that you have questions, and we want to help.
We want to be your doctor friends.
Julie, let's do a quick overview of our journey today. I am going to give us a little background to the condition, but then I want to get into audio from two great guests that will help us understand more. I have invited our friend and colleague, Dr. Chris DeWald, who between him and his father have over 60 years of experience treating scoliosis patients, to give us more insight. But also to add a different dimension, I have also asked Lauren Higginson, the founder of Higgy Bears, which is an organization dedicated to both support and a community that helps kids and families with the diagnosis of scoliosis. And she's going to introduce to us what life was like for her as a scoliosis patient, in addition to her insights of living with the condition, as well as observations she has from her community and her thoughts on screening. So do you have enough matcha with you to take this ride with me today?
Our listeners can hear my iced caffeinated beverage. I'm ready to go.
All right. So let's start with defining what we're talking about. There are different types of scoliosis, but for today, we're going to focus on adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, which is a mouthful, but is the most common. And I'm going to break that down for you on what that really is. The spine naturally curves front to back. So if we look at ourselves in the mirror standing sideways, our lower back curves inward, and we call this lordosis. And our mid-back near our shoulder blades curve outward, and we call this kyphosis. And this is normal. We are able to have problems with these curves of being too much or too little, but this is not scoliosis. If you have too much lordosis or too much kyphosis, which we've all seen before, that's a completely separate condition. Scoliosis, on the other hand, is the lateral curvature of the spine. So this, using the same mirror metaphor or analogy, we would be standing facing directly away from it. So if you could see your back into the mirror, and it's the left and right curvature. So according to Dr. DeWald, we really shouldn't have much curve in these directions. And, you know, again, we're all different. We all have little bit of differences. We're all not perfectly even. When somebody says I'm out of alignment, it usually doesn't mean that they're completely actually out of alignment and can be put back into alignment. But there isn't much curve going, you know, we should have a straight spine, which is why we were able to maybe have people bend forward and check them by nurses at a school. So the curve that is measured is called a Cobb angle. And I know that you and I are familiar with this because we take these measurements. But this angle really gives us a sense of the severity of the scoliosis and is defined as basically the maximum curvature. You're trying to say, where is it maximally curved? The definition of scoliosis is a Cobb angle of at least 10 degrees. So in summary, the type we focus on in children and adolescents, which is age 10 to 18, that's the adolescent part of the name, has an unknown cause, that's the idiopathic part of the name, and has a curve greater than 10 degrees. We've now got adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. You with me?
I'm right here with you.
It is the most common form of scoliosis, as I mentioned. And in the United States, the estimated prevalence of adolescent idiopathic scoliosis with a Cobb angle of at least 10 degrees among children and adolescents aged 10 to 16 is 1% to 3%. So a quick search showing that there's about 28 million kids in the United States within this age range. That's around 250 to 850,000 kids, to give us a sense. So it's not exactly a rare condition. But I think if I could talk to our listener right now, I would bet a decent percentage know very little about scoliosis other than its curvature in the spine and have never really checked themselves or maybe their children for it.
Yeah, and it might be something that they randomly find. I can't tell you how many times, because we take a lot of x-rays in our office because we both do musculoskeletal medicine, and it might be a hip x-ray, and you can see a little bit of their lumbar spine, or you might see that their pelvis is off on their hip x-ray, or you're getting a lumbar x-ray because they have back pain or something, and you're like, oh, by the way, you've got a little bit of scoliosis, and they'll be like, I was never told that. Or conversely, like I had a patient one time who was a young woman in her 20s, and she had been to the emergency department for another problem. I think she had some hip pain or something, and she was worried that she might have broken something. So they took pictures of her back, and she had, to, in my mind, a pretty mild scoliosis. I think her Cobb angle was like 10 or 12 or something, not terrible. And certainly not one that I would be like, oh goodness, you have to go see a spine specialist like Dr. DeWald or something. And somebody in the emergency department told her, they said the words to her, I can't believe that you can walk normally. So she was terrified. She came and talked to me, and it was like, I've been told that I should be scared, and I need to be dealing with this right this second. So clearly, medical professionals are ill-informed on this, even though it's what you're telling me is it's incredibly prevalent, you know, in the nature of musculoskeletal conditions. And I'm sure we'll get into this, but like oftentimes completely not symptomatic and may not ever lead to any problems whatsoever. So I won't step on your toes and our guest's toes, but I've seen both spectrums of it of like, huh, didn't even know that existed. And oh my gosh, I'm here because a doctor told me that this is very bad and I should be scared. And am I going to be paralyzed? And it's like, let's give the truth in it, that somewhere in the middle, please.
I love that. So why should we look for it? So why does it matter? Why does it matter more than the alignment or appearance of the spine? The concern is that curves can progress, Julie, especially as we grow and get older. And severe spinal curvature may be associated with adverse long-term health outcomes, for example, pulmonary disorders, disability, back pain, psychological effects, cosmetic issues, and reduced quality of life. So therefore, early identification and effective treatment of mild scoliosis could slow or stop curvature progression before skeletal maturity, and thereby certainly could improve long-term outcomes into adulthood. So, Julie, how do you feel about that as a prologue? Do you feel prepped and ready for our guests?
I feel like you put me on the straight and narrow, my friend. Let's go.
Did you do that on purpose?
Of course I did.
Good use of the word straight and narrow. I like it. So, okay. So I want to start off first with Dr. Chris DeWald. Dr. DeWald is a world's expert in the management of scoliosis, working for decades at Rush University Medical Center. Looking at his bio to give our listeners some details, I found his words were the best summary of Dr. DeWald. To quote him from his profile page, he says, "We see a lot of teenagers have scoliosis, and I operate on teenagers. I also brace teenagers to correct scoliosis. Maybe I'm not as hip as I think I am, but I seem to be able to relate and understand to how they feel and make both the parents and kids feel comfortable. And it's very important to talk to the kids, look right at them in the eye and talk to them, not just the parents. We also see adults, either adults who had the curve in their spine when they were kids or they develop it just from degeneration. We don't always have to operate. In fact, we prefer not to have to. If we find a patient that has a condition that can be treated properly, non-operatively, whether that's through physical therapy or medication or just time alone, that's obviously the ideal. We're in this business to take care of patients, not just be a surgeon." Isn't that just so, Dr. DeWald?
Oh my God, that's Chris to a T. I'm going to let him speak for himself, and then I want to tell a little anecdote about him afterwards.
Yeah, and just to preface this, he is as hip as he thinks he is. So I just want everybody to know that. So without further ado, let me have Dr. DeWald come on and give us some information. All right, Dr. DeWald, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to answer some questions on scoliosis. I want to start with just a real basic question about scoliosis. You know, we're not all perfectly straight or aligned. So if we were looking at somebody's back, what are some of the things that you would be noticing on maybe somebody who hadn't been diagnosed, and it would increase your like threshold to start saying this person may have scoliosis?
Well, there's a number of things. You know, first of all, just looking at someone's back, you look to see if the shoulders look level. You look at their waistline to see if the waist looks level. Does one leg look longer than the other? If they bend forward, what we call an Adam's test, they just bend over straight at their hips 90 degrees and one side looks higher than the other. Is it rotation? So you can see a rib prominence on one side versus the other, which suggests there's a scoliosis. But probably the first thing that people see is either shoulder asymmetry or one shoulder blade sticking out more than the other.
Yeah, I feel like the shoulder blade one is the one that shows up most in my office and was the one most recently that I had, where a kid had fallen on his back and had swelling over his shoulder blade and didn't tell anybody, and then it wasn't going away. So he showed his parents, he's 16, and they were like, "Whoa, it's really sticking out," and came in and it was pretty significant scoliosis. And that patient may be seeing you sometime in the near future, to be honest. What's your perspectives on screening? You know, like we're going to talk about on this episode the preventative task force recommendation and some of the recommendations by societies. But as a physician who treats this on a regular basis, what do you think we should be doing from a screening perspective?
Well, it certainly should be seen by the pediatricians. It's probably the most important well-child checks, school screen at the office. At one time, back when I first started in the 90s and actually in the 80s, there was a push to do school nurses to do school screening. But the feeling was that too many kids were getting early x-rays. And so really it's the pediatrician who, in the well child checks, just have the patient bend over at their hips and just do a quick check of their back. If they do see any kind of a prominence on one side versus asymmetry, frankly, one side looks higher than the other when they're bent over at 90 degrees, I do think they need a baseline x-ray. But a pediatrician seems to be more qualified than simply having a school nurse look for it, unless the school nurse is really tuned into scoliosis. And so, you know, there was a real strong push, like I said, back in the 80s or so, back in the 90s, where all the school nurses were checking routinely for kids, but just seeing that too many were getting x-rays. So the pediatricians is the key.
Yeah, the current recommendation is kind of an insufficient. They don't have enough data whether to say that or not. But it's interesting because there are still a bunch of states who do that school-based screening, and not everybody still does. And I think it's highly controversial because obviously you don't want to miss any, but I agree with you. I think, you know, how are these people getting training? Are we doing too many x-rays? Is there too much false positives? Vice versa, you know, speaking with our patient earlier, you know, her concern was, you know, the false positives don't tend to have too much downside because it's a single x-ray, and she wants everybody to be able to be, you know, screened and find it as much as we can. And I certainly understood that perspective too. And so I think that's kind of why we're in that insufficient evidence, you know, world that we're in right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if they do have school screening, I think the key is that they send them to the pediatrician, obviously. And so I don't have a strong objection to it. I mean, as long as someone's taking a look at the child's back. And because the biggest concern, which I'm sure we'll get into, is a concern for progression.
Right.
And so if you don't look at it and don't have a baseline, either x-ray or an exam, these curves can progress 10 degrees in 6 months. And so you go from a 30 to 40 degree and may become more significant. So I do think it should be, you know, I mean, you think about well child care, it's usually once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot can happen in that year. So if something is noted at the school, it should be brought to the parents' attention and brought in to see their pediatrician.
Yeah, that's great. Let's build off that. So you see a patient in the office, it's a new diagnosis of scoliosis, you know, brand new diagnosis. Kind of walk us through what that visit looks like and certainly based on severity and so on and so forth.
Well, the most important is that the vast majority of scoliosis is what we call idiopathic. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit later as well. But idiopathic means we don't know the cause of it. So the first thing you got to do is to make sure it's not a problematic scoliosis or a pathologic scoliosis. So your neurologic examination is very important. So first of all, you have to examine the child's back to look to see if there is a scoliosis. But you're looking for anything that's out of the norm from a regular scoliosis. And what I mean by that is that idiopathic curves have kind of a standard pattern. The vast majority go to the right in the upper spine and the left in the lower spine. If it's a reverse curve, that's something that kind of catches our attention. It has nothing to do with right-handedness or left-handedness, but you need to look at the pattern of the curve, the age of the patient. Do they have a lot of growth to go? Are they already done with their growth peak? Like a family history, does a mother have scoliosis? There is a family history of scoliosis. And then you get down to the neurologic exam, as we started to talk about, that you really check in to make sure the reflexes are normal, that their motor function is normal, their gait is normal, their coordination is normal. And to that matter, again, you ask about birth history. And so it's a very involved examination that first time. But that's really to rule out all the abnormal curves. By far, the vast majority of curves we see are called idiopathic, and they don't have any of the strong neurologic issues at all or abnormalities in their curve. They may have the family history, but their examination, except for the curve, is relatively normal. The next step would be then to get an x-ray and to evaluate the x-ray and look for any how big the curve is and determine the severity of the curve, because that's going to help make our determination for treatment.
Yeah, so talk about some of the severity there. You know, like, how are you classifying these things?
Well, simply put, it's classified. First of all, we have to decide if it's a neuromuscular curve or idiopathic. We're going to go, for the most part of our discussion here, I assume we're talking about idiopathic scoliosis.
Yeah, let's stick with that, which is the most common and mostly what people are familiar with.
Right. And again, the teenager, the preteen is completely normal, and it surprises the parents. A lot of these curves, they're born completely normal. The spine is straight from the backside. Their growth is fairly normal. And they start to develop these curves someplace either late, 9, 10, 11. But typically, it's early adolescence. So it's usually 12, 13, 14. And at that time, the kids are kind of no longer running around in their underwear, and the parents haven't seen them without their shirt on. And they're surprised often that they've had this growth peak, and all of a sudden the curve jumps up on them. So it's all about, how big is this curve when we see them. For the most part, we break down curves based on size. So curves less than 30 degrees, we consider mild or minimal. Curves between 30 and 50 are moderate curves, and curves bigger than 50 degrees are severe curves. And it's really all about how much they're going to grow. So a 30-degree curve in a 18-year-old teenager doesn't bother me much at all. That's not a dangerous curve. But a 30-degree curve in a 10-year-old who hasn't even started their growth peak, it's a much more of a concern, because that one can really get much bigger. I mean, there are curves that are 80, 90 degrees that require surgery. We don't want to let them get that big. So we want to be able to treat them. And the most common way to treat a growing preteen or teenager is with a brace.
Yeah, why don't you talk some more about the bracing?
As I told you, this is kind of rote. I go through these conversations, so I'm sorry if I keep getting ahead of us.
No, it's great. No, this is the point. We want people to have an inside look at what it is and sitting in these appointments and having an understanding. A lot of people are going to end up with this diagnosis that don't know about it, and this can be a great reference for them.
Yeah, we start to consider bracing in a growing preteen or teenager. So if they're 18 and they're well beyond maturity and they're taller than their mother and their father, we're not thinking about bracing. But bracing is not like bracing of the teeth. We can't really grab onto the spine and straighten it out. We're kind of holding the spine as they go through the peak growth so it doesn't get into the surgical range. So if we can start to brace at 30 degrees, we'll go through our main criteria. But if we start to brace at 30, usually the best outcome is that when they're done growing, they end at 30 degrees. So they may look like they're better in the brace because they're pushing on the curve, but it's just to hold it during their fast growth. If they get a little correction, that's a bonus. But for the most part, we're trying to stabilize the curve as they go through growth peak. So typically bracing is in a growing preteen or teenager with a 25-degree curve or more the first time we see them, or if we've seen 5 degrees of progression in 6 months. So typically, if I see, it's easy to talk about examples. If I see someone has a 15-degree curve, I'm not going to brace that child. We're going to watch them. Some of these curves do sort of straighten out as they go through growth, but if it gets bigger, we're going to want to brace that child. And bracing, for the most part, you want to go at least 14 hours a day when they're hitting that fast growth. But the more you wear it, up to 18 or 20 hours, actually the better results we're able to control the curve. I don't like to take away their sports because I think it's very important for their psychological, physical, and emotional aspect and social aspect for their kids. So if they're going to be playing a sport, which is fine, I just don't want them to play 5 sports, so they're out of the brace. But if they're wearing the brace up to 16, 18 hours a day, so that's during school and at nighttime, and then take it off for their sports, we have very good results. Good results mean we're able to control the curve in 75 to 80% of the time in a growing teenager, preteen, to keep them away from surgery. So they make it a little bigger in the curve, but without the brace, they're at best 50-50 to going to head towards surgery. So bracing has truly shown that we can change the natural history of the curve. Physical therapy is additive. It can help. Chiropractic treatment, I'm not sure if it helps or doesn't hurt, but neither one of them has shown to be a change in natural history of controlling the curve like a hard brace can.
So do the kids sleep in the brace then to try to accomplish that 16 to 18 hours as well?
Absolutely. It's sleeping seems to be the easiest time. There are some nighttime bending braces. If they have a single curve, there's something called a Charleston nighttime brace that some doctors have used. But if they have a single curve, that means they have to sleep in a brace that's bending them reverse. But it's really that the best results have been the longer you wear it. So when you're upright in school and in sleeping, it seems to be better than just the nighttime bracing.
That makes a lot of sense. It sounds like you're seeing these kids back on a regular basis, at least after diagnosis. How frequently are you checking?
So for the growing preteen or teenager, for women, for girls, it's premenarchal girls in particular, or less than 2 years after they started the menstrual periods. I'll be watching them every 4 months. And then as they mature, I'll go to every 6 months. And then perhaps when they're in later high school or even college, I'll check them every other year just to know where they are before they're over 25. I've seen some late adolescent progression. And a lot of the pediatric docs will after 18, they don't see them. And so we do see some late progression. So I do think they don't need to be followed every 4 months at that time. But when they're growing very quickly, I think every 4 months we check their height. We may or may not x-ray them every single time, but at least they needed an examination. If I skip one visit with an x-ray to decrease the amount of radiation, for sure the next time I'm going to get an x-ray. But it's mainly the clinical evaluation and measuring how tall they are and looking at their back to see if there's been a change.
So for somebody who has a very mild curve, let's say 15 degrees or 10 to 15 degrees, very, very mild, but they're in the growing phase, that's still something that would be regularly followed to make sure it's not progressing?
At least a couple of visits. Because yeah. if it doesn't seem to progress, then I can go to the 6 months and maybe even a whole year. But I want at least a couple of visits to know nothing's changing.
Yeah, that's great. So talk to us about then the surgical criteria. When are kids or are people getting surgery for this?
Well, I'll give you, the main criteria is the size of the curve. And really it comes down to, we know that when you're done growing, if a curve is only about 30 degrees, it probably is going to cause much problem throughout your lifetime. But if the curve is around 50 degrees when you're done growing, those curves will slowly progress, not because of growth anymore, but from degeneration. So just like grandmas and grandpas are shorter than they are as young men and women, we lose height mostly through our joint spaces and our disc spaces. And if the curve is large enough, the inside of the curve and the concave portion of the curve will slowly get worse. And so we'll see a progression of about 1 to 2 degrees throughout their lifetime, per year, throughout their lifetime, when a curve is over 50 degrees. So just for easy math, a 15-year-old with a 50-degree curve, they may be fairly done growing. By the time they're, 40 years later, when they're 55, so still active adult, their curve could be up around 90 degrees.
Wow.
So that's why we recommend surgery for curves around 50, because the odds are it's going to continue to progress. It won't progress quickly, but it's a slow progression, and they're still active in their adult life when it may need to be treated. Whereas curves that are closer to 30 may never progress significantly. So it really it's kind of our mark is that 50-degree level. Then when it's above 50 degrees, we're considering surgery because we can anticipate odds are they're going to have a problem as a functioning adult.
Yeah.
If it wasn't going to be a problem till they're 85, you may want to take your chances. But if you're going to have a problem at age 50, you probably want to take care of it sooner. So that's really kind of how we judge it. Now, I'll just give you two quick examples. I had a patient who was 12 years old. She came into the office. She already had a 68-degree curve. Now, she hasn't even started her peak growth. That's only going to get a very, it's going to progress substantially because they're just starting their peak growth. We're not waiting on that teenager. We're recommending surgery probably within a few months. Whereas, again, I mentioned like a junior in high school, 3 years past her menstrual period starting, looks very mature, and she has a 52-degree curve. We can wait and watch her all through college because there's no urgency at that point. And so really it depends on where they are in the growth phase and how big the curve is.
Yeah, those are two great examples. So I think that the common brain would think that if you're going to do surgery, what you're doing is just basically straightening this thing out and putting rods on it. But it may be more complex than that. Can you give us an insight into what you actually do here?
Well, it's not much more complicated than that. It's just it does take a little time to be able to do it. Basically what we're trying to do is we're putting in screws or hooks onto the spine to fix onto the vertebrae. And then we're slowly pulling the curve or the spine to a straight rod that we have pre-measured, pre-bent, and in surgery. So the longest part of the surgery is exposing the spine and safely putting in implants into the bone. And we do that under x-ray, under CT, guided imaging perhaps. And then you would slowly pull the spine to the rod. And I like my analogy is you have a big suitcase. It's hard to close a big fat suitcase in the middle, but if you slowly start from the end and like a zipper and bring it closer and closer, the other screws in the mid portion of the spine are coming closer and closer to the rod, and so you can actually get a pretty powerful correction on the flexible teenagers. You can get an 80-degree curve down almost 20 degrees or so. So it's pretty
wow.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's a really. That's a really good analogy.
The the biggest concern or biggest risk is that there is risk of neurologic injury. And this is why we don't operate on everybody. When we are putting implants in the spine, the spinal cord is there. And we do worry about this very small risk of a neurologic injury, of paralysis. Now, frankly, that's less than 1%. It's actually less than a quarter of a percent. But it's not 1 out of 1,000,000. It's something that our greatest focus that we need to have very good neurologic monitoring, which we have neurologic monitoring from the head all the way down the feet, and the kids are being monitored throughout the surgery continually and also intermittently at different times of the procedure. So that's our main focus. Obviously, a good, healthy teenager, it's got to be our main focus.
Yeah. The surgery is done on people who are going to be living, generally speaking, a very long time following that surgery. Is the duration of the outcome pretty good? Like, do they need repeat procedures later on in life, or it tends to be they do, you know, they recover well and without complication do pretty well for life?
That's a great question. You know, I take care of both adult and teenagers and preteens with scoliosis, and it is much easier to take care of a teenager than it is an adult with that I have to treat a scoliosis that had never been treated before. Yes, there's probably about 20-30% of the scoliosis patients that eventually wear out the discs below the previous fusion. It really depends how long the fusion is to begin with, but they may have to go through additional surgery 40 years, 30 years down the line. But again, my experience is it's much easier to extend the fusion that's already been treated than trying to treat a whole scoliosis as an adult. So I do educate those that we operate on that, yes, they still can be back and active, but they really shouldn't be a extreme athlete, you know, someone, who's doing military-type workouts and really just beating up their spine, because it is potentially it can wear out the mobile discs below the fusion, not the fusion itself. The fusion itself does great, but they, you know, we're talking 30 years down the line of wear and tear below a fusion. So you educate them that, and I will say that the one thing they cannot do, the one restriction is gymnastics and tumbling. The rods you cannot bend. And so this gets to some of the activities. We rule out tumbling and gymnastics and contact sports, but, you know, there's a lot of other things that, you know, bike riding can be easy, but then you can also have kind of aggressive bike rider who's jumping and doing flips. And so you gotta be, education is important after the spinal fusions.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a question you get a lot of times, is kind of what they can do afterward. That's a really, really good point. And so contact sports, I think American football, but how about some of the gray zone, like basketball and soccer, where like theoretically there is contact, but it's not intentional.
Yeah, no, we let them play those sports. I think, soccer can have some issues and same with basketball, but they can play those sports. And some of the kids surprisingly choose their, like tennis or something where they can still be active, but they avoid some of the collision type activities. But those are kind of yellow lights, not red lights. We would let them play different sports. They can ski, and those who can water ski. Those who can ice skate. I don't think it's a good thing to learn how to ice skate or snowboard if you haven't tried before. But they just got to be careful, and they can do it. They can be pretty active. You'd be surprised, you know, what people have done when they've had a spine fusion as a teenager. They're pretty normal.
Yeah, that's I think that's pretty incredible, to be honest, especially when you see the x-ray and see what it looks like and what they can do on the outside. So that's great stuff. The if I'm a 13-year-old and you started me on a brace, like, how do I know what, like, I had to have braces on my teeth and I couldn't wait to get those off. So like, when does somebody stop needing a brace? How do you decide when it's time?
Well, it's about growth. So and that's why we measure them when they come in. We check their height. It is a little easier with women. The girls tend to hit their growth peak a little earlier and faster, and then they're done about mid. You know, girls usually finish between age 14 to 16. Most boys will finish growing between 16 and 18. That puts them into later high school. So it's a little more difficult trying to brace boys. By the way, we do see much more girls than boys, and we don't, again, know why. It's about 75 to 80% girls and 20-25% boys. So that's a little unusual. But, again, to answer your question, we look at growth plates on the x-rays to see if the spine looks mature growth-wise. We measure their height. We ask about how tall mom and dad are. We can kind of judge that. And it's all about trying to determine when they've already gone through their peak growth. We can start to wean them out of their brace. So usually if I had them in full time, let's say 18 hours a day, we got them down then to 14 hours a day, and then it's just 8 hours overnight. We may do that for the last year, maybe sophomore year in high school, for instance, they're just wearing it at nighttime, and they're not even wearing it to school by that time. So it really depends on how much they're growing and their physical maturity.
Sounds like these people become pretty longstanding patients for you. I'm sure you have a lot of close relationships with a lot of your patients. They're seeing you quite frequently during peak times of their development.
Yeah, it's actually it's probably one of my most rewarding parts of being a physician is that, you know, I think a lot of pediatricians see sick kids because they come in to see them. But I'm seeing very healthy, active teenagers who just happen to have a scoliosis. And it's kind of fun to watch them grow. And, you know, I know them from age 10. And even if I operate or don't operate, I don't watch them. And some of them come back. I've been in practice long enough. They've come back now. They're married and they want to ask questions about having children. And so we're there now. So let's talk about it. For the most part, there is a genetic component to scoliosis, but it's not one gene that's going to be passed on. Nothing says that the patient's kids are going to have scoliosis, but I educate them that they should bring it up to the pediatrician. You know, I did have scoliosis. Can you please check my child? It's probably a little, you know, we say about 3% of the population has a scoliosis. It's quite a bit. Only about a tenth of those will develop a curve around 30 degrees or more. So if you have a scoliosis, it's probably closer to 10% that your kids may have scoliosis, but it may not be anything severe, just something that needs to be observed and watched. But getting back to pregnancy, I've seen many, many scoliosis kids with or without surgery go on. They have very successful, have no problem with their carrying a child or having babies. And I've seen people with beautiful straight spines have back pain and have trouble. So it's,
right,
go either way. But for the most part, we don't put any restrictions on that. Probably the biggest issue is the OB has got to be aware of it, obviously.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's great you went into that because I was about to ask you about the genetics. You brought that up before. In terms of like family members, like is siblings and such, I mean, if somebody gets diagnosed, is there a high rate of siblings and such having the same thing, or it's all just kind of random to a certain extent?
No, it goes up to about it. One sibling has it, there's a little higher incidence that the other sibling will have it. Interestingly, identical twins are the ones that are going to be most likely. If one, this really kind of proves out the genetic component, yeah, to it. I mean, as high as 80% of one identical twin has it, the other one will have it. But non-identical twins is probably about 10%, for instance. So if one sibling, the other sibling.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. What about sort of like more towards end of life? So somebody who, not end of life per se, but the later year, decades of life. So you have somebody who had scoliosis and now they're in 40 and their curve's probably not progressing, but now they're 70 and maybe they're starting to shrink a little bit. You know, like how is it managed at that point?
Well, this is kind of what I was getting to earlier with, you know, it's easier to take care of the 15-year-old, yeah, than the 70-year-old with a big scoliosis because they do have other issues, but I will say that it seems that those are my two areas to take care of. I just operated on a 7-year-old woman today, or 68, I guess she was. And what happens is that as the discs degenerate within a curve that's never been treated, their curve does progress and does get worse, and they have more pain. If they don't have a lot of pain, we're not going to treat it, even if the curve is getting slowly bigger. But you usually don't develop any organ compression or respiratory issues unless the curve's around 90 degrees.
But okay,
it's mostly back pain. So if you're having more and more back pain, we sometimes have to operate in the 70s, even late 70s, to stabilize the spine so it stops kind of, you know, becoming a Jenga tower, frankly, is that the discs are wearing out and the vertebrae are kind of malaligned and they can't, it's hard to hold themselves upright. And the treatment for that is fairly similar to the teenagers. We just don't get as much correction. It's more stabilization. I kind of think of it like an internal brace in those patients versus trying to get it perfectly straight. We just want to stabilize them so they can have less pain when they're walking around.
Yeah, it seems like
doing their chores. Yep.
It seems like for the older patient, again, it sounds like you're saying it's more based on symptoms. You're not necessarily following them on an annual basis to see if the curve is necessarily getting worse. It's all based on whether they're feeling more or showing more issues.
That's correct, but it seems that most of the scoliosis patients who are that age know they have a scoliosis, and they feel like it's going to get them, if you will. Yeah. So they like to have a routine appointment.
X-ray, yeah.
So, and one every year is probably way too much, but every 2 to 5 years, they probably need to check in and kind of know where you're at. Different things can allow the curve get bigger. Multiple pregnancies may, you know, it's a linear line. We say 1 to 2 degrees per year, but there are increases during certain parts of your life, with multi pregnancies, with during postmenopausal, if you go through a period of medical treatment, chemotherapy, radiation, conditions the muscles to hold you upright. So a lot of what we try to do is try to keep the core strong, to try to prevent gravity, if you will, from increasing, pulling down the spine, and trying to fight that or slow the progression of the curve down.
I'm going to wrap up here. You've been doing this for a while. You've treated scoliosis patients for decades now. I'm sure there's been a bunch of new developments that have happened over the time of treatment, and maybe they've been minor. But you know, kind of where do you see the treatment of this going? Are there things that are coming down the pipeline? Is it that techniques are just being, you know, minorly improved? Where are we at with scoliosis treatment?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the advances have been surgical, frankly, and it's. You know, there's a lot. It'd be great if we can figure out a non-operative treatment for scoliosis. And there is some push for now some kind of like an internal tether that is like a braces on the teeth, but it still takes a procedure. You still have to make an incision to put on the front of the spine a non-fusion device, but it is a surgical procedure. So it'd be great to have some type of new brace, but a lot of braces have come and gone, Overall, it seems the only way we've really kind of improved is neurologic safety with the surgery and correction of the spine. But I would love to see better and better non-operative or preventive treatment for scoliosis. There's a lot of genetic research still being done, looking for if we can identify what genes are really responsible. It seems to be a multitude of genes, and maybe we can identify which ones are more likely going to be a fast progressor or a definitive progressor, maybe treat that one sooner. And that this one is very low risk for progression. So genetics and non-operative treatment is where I like to see us go, but most of the advancements have been in surgery.
Great. Well, one of the things that you and I talked about before we started the interview was I'm interviewing Lauren from Higgy Bears regarding this episode, and you said that you'd had some experience with those bears. So if you can kind of comment on what you've seen and maybe patients using those and such.
Well, who doesn't like a teddy bear? I mean, that's just the bottom line. Or a Higgy Bear. It's so when we got to tell someone they got to go in a brace, it's not good news. You know, no one likes a brace. Now, actually, a lot of the girls get used to it. They kind of embrace it, no pun intended. They realize it's trying to keep them away from surgery, but it's still foreign. It's still something they got to wear, and they don't like it. If you can help them by giving them a bear that has a brace on, it seems to ease some of the tension and break some of the ice. The other thing is same thing. We even have bears that have rods in, or at least an X-ray with a rod in. So the same thing, if they require surgery, we like to show them a bear that has gone through the same idea. So it's just a way to recognize that we're still dealing with teenagers and preteens, and this is not an easy thing to tackle, and they're going to still be healthy, beautiful teenagers, so not to worry. But that's the whole idea of the bears.
Great. Well, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, maybe give a sense of people, you know, where are you practicing? If people love this interview and want to come find you, where can they find you?
Well, I've been at Rush since 1994, so it's haven't changed. I'm over at the university offices, Rush University. I'm actually part of the dual appointed neurosurgery orthopedics, and you call the neurosurgical department, or you can call the hospital and get my name and my number, and happy to see you and discuss the scoliosis. It doesn't mean you need surgery, nor does it mean you need a brace. You just need an evaluation.
Yeah, speaking from experience, Dr. DeWald is a wealth of knowledge, and it's we're very lucky to be able to refer our scoliosis patients, knowing that they're in good hands. In fact, the patient who was the nidus for this episode and I talk about in the intro will be seeing Dr. DeWald in the very near future. So we're very lucky is what I'm trying to say. So thanks for the time. We will share all this information, and we'll put your information in the show notes. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You know, this is my, as I say to the patients when I see them, I have to go from the beginning because it's a lot to hear. And I think it's sometimes hearing it a couple times helps. So I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to talk about it.
All right, Julie, you promised an anecdote following the Dr. DeWald interview. So why don't you hit us with this wonderful anecdote?
First off, hot take, which is not a hot take. I love Chris DeWald. He is one of my favorite orthopedic people I've ever worked with throughout my entire career. I adore this person. He's just a I think our listeners will pick up on that just listening to him, you know, talk about scoliosis. And he's just a very genuine, very kind, lovely human being. And the anecdote I want to tell, and I'll try to be brief about it, and Chris already knows this story, and pretty much every time I talk about him or I refer a patient to him that doesn't know him to give them some context and some buy-in, I'll tell this story. And it also makes me look really good. So that's why I like this story too. But for a while, our group, this was probably even before maybe you started working with us, Jeremy, they would give us our patient satisfaction score ranking. They wouldn't give us the ranking of where like every single physician in the group was, but they would give you your personal ranking of, say, there's 50 physicians in our group. They'd give you what number you are. And for a while, and then they stopped doing it a while ago, but for a while I was number two, and I was very proud of that, but I'm also a perfectionist, so I was like, who's number one? You know, I wanted to know. And so I asked around, because you can get information. I have birds everywhere, little birds everywhere. And I found out that it was Chris DeWald. And so I confronted him. I was like, Chris, this is when he was still at our practice. I was like, Chris, a little birdie told me that you might be ranked number one, you know, for the patient satisfaction scores. And he was like, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, you know. And so he confirmed that for me, basically. And then he said, well, you know, some of the higher-ups asked me to speak to some of the other physicians in our practice to try to give them, like, tips and tricks about how they can improve their scores. And he was like, well, I don't know. All I'm going to do is tell them to see fewer patients and spend more time with people. So I don't know how that's going to go over. Which I still think that would be really great information to tell people, but doesn't always work within, you know, a very busy orthopedic practice. But that's Chris DeWald to a T, and he certainly showed his true colors in this interview. So I think he's a wonderful human being, and clearly his patients think so too. And I love being educated by him. And certainly when we were working at the same office on Tuesdays, we'd be at the same office. There are so many times I would run across the hall and be like, Chris, can you look at this x-ray? Chris, can you tell me what to do for this young person that has a spondylolysis or a scoliosis or a spine problem, that I was a new physician and I needed his help? And he always, 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 always helped me. And he continues to. He's the first one I'll call or text, you know, if I have a difficult case. And I'm just so glad that you know, he did this interview, because he's great.
Yeah, needless to say, it was not hard to decide who the expert I wanted to have on this episode was going to be. And certainly another sign of who Chris DeWald was is he finished operating, and the minute he finished operating, came out and did this interview. So he's actually in the surgical suites with his surgical gear on doing this interview, really fitting into, you know, the whole vibe of it, even though he says he doesn't always need to do surgery. So yeah, it was great. A while back, we tried something on this podcast that I think was actually great, and we never really got back to it. We did an episode completely dedicated to a patient telling their story and learning from them. On the whole, I think a lot of us will say we learn a ton from our patients, and therefore I think we should include them in these conversations as well. And we've tried to do that. I think people who've hung with us for the past couple of weeks have noticed that. So rather than a separate episode of a patient story, I wanted to actually, within this episode, introduce you to Lauren Higginson, the founder of Higgy Bears and a scoliosis patient herself. Higgy Bears is an incredible organization that I will let Lauren introduce further, but it has provided a support system for a ton of people with scoliosis. And Dr. DeWald actually has patients who do use Higgy Bears, and he has a lot of familiarity with the group itself, which was kind of a cool circle, small world thing to be doing as I did this episode together. So I'm going to get into an interview with Lauren. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Your experience and perspective is an invaluable contribution to this episode on scoliosis. I feel like a common thread for many people with chronic disease, whether it be scoliosis in this case, or really any chronic disease, is the profound effect the condition has on basically every part of their life. Would you mind kind of sharing your story and how that maybe ties into something like that?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. So I was diagnosed with scoliosis when I was around 12 or 13, in a school screening, and I went to the doctor and he said, you have a curve and there's really not much to do about it. You'll grow out of it. It's fine. Fast forward to when I was an adult at 26, my curve was 50 degrees, and I had to have surgery. So that doctor clearly, you know, didn't give me the best advice. But I had surgery, and during the first surgery, I lost motor function, so they had to do a second surgery. And then I was in a head-on car accident after the third, and my screws came loose. So I had a really rough go of surgery, but I had a couple years off of work to really think about ways to help other scoliosis patients. When I was growing up, I felt incredibly depressed. I just felt like I was the only one that had scoliosis. I never knew anyone else. And I knew I wanted to find a way to let kids know that they're not alone in this journey. So I started Hickey Bears to do that. But yeah, I think it has a profound effect on the emotional side and social side of it.
So you were diagnosed when you were 12 or 13. And leading up to that point, it sounded like you said you felt like you would have had no idea you had scoliosis.
Right. Yeah. I mean, prior to the exam, I felt normal. I felt happy. I didn't think anything was wrong with me. And then once I went to the doctor and they did x-ray and they confirmed I have scoliosis, he said, you know, you have a deformity. That word stuck with me. And I walked out of that appointment. Like, I walked in super happy. I walked out depressed, you know, feeling I was deformed, alone. Like, I just went from a 10 on the happiness scale to like a negative 5. Like, it just drastically changed my whole outlook. Like, I went from a happy kid to a super depressed kid.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Lauren, because deformity is technically a correct pathologic term, but I can see how that would have an effect on a human being, and maybe a better word choice from a physician at that time, at least especially on that first visit, would make sense. I don't know if you've had to sit with that word for a long time. Do you feel like there's better words we could be using?
I mean, I get it. Like, I know there was a big push a couple years ago to not use that word, but I mean, I get that's the medical terminology for it. Maybe not using it with a 12 or 13 year old girl maybe might be better.
Or anybody who's 12 or 13, or frankly, right. 35 is probably a good idea. I mean, again, if in the note, the medical note is one thing, but to the human being is another. So I think using curvature, a lot of times I'm very, I use a lot of visual, and so I use the x-ray to kind of just explain it, and I don't technically label it per se. I'm not like, you have a deformity here. I usually say, well, look at this curvature, and then this is what should be normal, and this is why that's abnormal, and so on and so forth, and I try to give them angles and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's important, because, I mean, it's just using that word, or just it just has a big... It sticks. I mean, I'm 37 and, you know, I still feel it. So
do you remember what happened after that? So you walked out, and maybe not like the 15 minutes after, but like, do you remember the subsequent few weeks to months after getting that diagnosis?
I had like a rib hump on my back that I never even knew was not normal until that appointment. And after that appointment, I lived in hoodies. I tried everything to hide that rib hump from everybody. Like, I would sit in a certain seat in class so that no one could see the right side of my body. I would stand a certain way in a group. Like, 100% of my mental energy went towards not letting people see the rib hump on my back. And I just didn't tell anybody about it. Honestly, it was never even talked about really again in my family. It was just, oh, the doctor said you're fine, let's move on, and kind of, you know, unfortunately, kind of was like, get over it.
What happened at age 26 or 27? How did you know that you got looked at again, obviously? Like, what changed?
Yeah. So I went back to the doctor when I was like 18, and he said, yeah, your curves are about 50 or so. The surgery is a huge deal, so let's take it slow. Let's watch you over the next couple of years, see how things go. And then it got to the point where I was having a lot of pain, and, you know, my back was deteriorating quite a bit, my discs were, and it just got to the point where I needed to have the surgery.
Yeah. Talk about the surgery a little bit. I know that you had a few, but maybe talk about the initial one and kind of how you talked to other people about surgeries and maybe what you were feeling going into it and how it was explained to you.
So I was over the moon excited about the surgery. Like, when I first read that there was a surgery to fix this and I could feel normal, you know, I mean, even though kids are normal with it, but that's just how I felt. I was pumped. I was like, get me in this operating room. Let's go. I was so excited. And, you know, when I talk to kids about it, I try to just let them, I don't say it in a way that, you know, you're going to have the surgery and you're going to be normal again afterwards. But just say, you know, look at the positives of this. You can, you know, you'll feel better about your back. Like, You'll be able to wear cuter clothes that you like. You'll be able to do more activities without pain and just focusing on the positive. And I just tell them that, you know, you're gonna, like, the time up to the surgery is hard because you're gonna worry about the what ifs and things like that. But just try to stay, you know, make some friends with scoliosis, do some fun things with them. Just keep your mind busy so you don't think about it. But I really just try to, like, reiterate there's a lot of positives from the surgery.
How was the recovery? Were you pumped after the surgery?
I was pumped with meds. it was rough. It was a rough surgery. But, you know, again, I was 26. Most kids are, like, a lot younger. They're teens when they have it. They recover so much quicker. But I wouldn't have got through it without my amazing husband. He was awesome. And, but yeah, it was pretty rough.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about your organization, Higgy Bears?
Yeah. Sure. So Higgy Bears, I started in 2014 as a business, but I transitioned it into a nonprofit a couple years ago. I make little teddy bears for kids that have scoliosis. So I make little back braces for them, for kids that wear braces. And then I sew a little scar in the back for kids that have had surgery. They're not just for kids, they're for teens and adults too. Teens really love them. But it started off just with the bears, and I've been able to make the bears free for patients, which is really great. That's always been a huge goal of mine. But in addition to the bears, I have support groups. I have Zooms that I do for the kids that are really fun. The big convention coming up. It's turned into a whole support aspect in addition to the bears.
That's really great. It obviously seems like there was a big hole in this area, seeing as you started this off as a business, and then gradually it just seemed to naturally turn into a full support system nonprofit. So maybe give me a sense of kind of how you've noticed with your scoliosis patients that have come to you, kind of the things that they've been looking for and their lack of support going into it.
Yeah. So the kids will come to me, or the parents will come to me and just say, my daughter or my son is just struggling. There's no one else in their school that has scoliosis. They feel like an outsider. You know, it's hard physically to wear the brace, but emotionally they're just struggling. The kids are. And that's when I get them involved with the Higgy Zooms. I have just kids from all over the country and all over the world really join, and we just play online games together, and some kids show what pattern they have on their braces and things like that. And it really just opens the kids up to a whole new world that, like, there's thousands and millions of kids that have scoliosis, and it really helps them emotionally a ton. But I think the emotional part of it is where we're lacking, and I'm trying to make a big difference in that aspect. But yeah, I think that's what a lot of kids struggle with.
Yeah, we've seen in many areas of medicine that community and feeling not isolated, feeling not lonely is actually really important for health, even if you don't have a chronic disease for that matter. But if you do have something that binds you with somebody else because you guys are both going through the same experience, we've seen significant benefits. Group visits where people actually come and they see a physician or they see a medical provider, and there's more than one person seeing that person at the same time, has actually had really good data on it, because people ask questions that they didn't know that they should be asking, or they can build off people's experiences. There's a lot of moments where people say, wow, I didn't know I was not the only one going through this, or I was having that same experience. So what you're doing is fantastic. With my day job, I find myself present for many people's day one with this diagnosis. You know, they walk in and, you know, maybe in your case, when you were 12 or 13, you were found at a screening. Were you having any symptoms at that time? Did you have back pain, or did you notice any symptoms that would have led you to scoliosis?
No, not that I remember. So the school screening really was, you know, a godsend for me. So yeah. I think that's important.
I do find that the majority of the scoliosis diagnoses I make are not on people who are coming in with what you would think is like back pain. Most of them are coming in with other complaints. Sometimes it's they look off or they seem imbalanced. Sometimes it's completely unrelated and we're doing an exam for a shoulder problem and you notice it. But yeah. Like I said, I'm there for many people's day one. I can imagine that no matter how good of a job I feel like I do explaining the condition and the next steps and being present and trying to be supportive, there are probably a million questions and concerns that manifest as soon as you walk out of the office. So what are some of the things you focus on with someone who is newly diagnosed and then reaches out for support?
The main thing I like to do, if I can get them on a Zoom, is to have all the kids, you know, kind of say, you know, you're not alone in this. Here are some tips for school and that type of thing. A lot of kids, probably the majority of kids, don't want to come on a Zoom because they're just going through a really hard time and that's kind of the last thing they want to do. So I just try to talk to them one-on-one and just let them know that there are so many kids going through this. And even though they don't know someone at their school, or they most likely don't, you know, there's a lot of ways I can connect them with other kids. And like for me, for example, when I was diagnosed, I went from age 13 to until I was 26 and had my surgery. I didn't tell a single person I had scoliosis. So I hid it and just it just ripped me, you know, it was awful. Like it just affected me so much from having to hide that. And so as soon as I can open the kids up to the Higgy Bears community, it just makes the world of difference to them. So I think the main thing I focus on is just letting them know that they're not alone.
I would imagine that some of the most common questions that start off are things like, what is this going to do to me as I get older? Or what is my life going to like? And I'm sure if you have to share your personal story, it's probably scaring a lot of people just because obviously you went through a lot, Lauren. And because you did, you're doing a lot of great stuff. I'm sure you wish you didn't have to go through those things, but also it's led to you to a life purpose. But, you know, maybe give me a sense when people ask the question of like, what is, you know, a parent or a kid says, you know, what is this going to look like for the rest of my life? How you kind of go through that with them?
Yeah, so I remind people, first of all, I don't generally tell parents and kids my story because it is scary. But I remind people that I was 26 when I had it. It was 10 years ago. And even though I had a complication, I'm fine now. But I tell people that they're going to lead, you know, a very normal life. Like there's great treatments. Just work hard at your bracing. If you do need surgery, there are thousands of kids that have had surgery and, you know, they're all okay. And just, it's part of your life. I always tell kids it's part of their life, but it's not going to be their whole life.
Yeah. And we focused on that earlier too, a situation where sometimes you can feel like you are the disease versus the disease being part of you. So I think that that's a very important message. You have some awesome resources on your website, including a 19-page support guide for scoliosis that I noticed and flipped through a little bit. We will certainly provide links to your website and that support guide in our show notes, but maybe share some of your favorite resources you recommend or places you send people.
Yeah. So my favorite organization that I work with is called Scolios Us. It's a great nonprofit that my friend Megan runs, and she has a mentor program for kids where she connects experienced kids with scoliosis with other kids starting off or that may be having a hard time. The Zooms are super fun. I just create like a fun atmosphere, but the one-on-one aspect of her program is really great because the kids become really good friends with their mentors. She also has a lot of mental health programs to help kids called the Empower Hour. So I do the fun stuff. She does the fun and serious stuff. So I highly, highly recommend her. And then in the support guide, I have information on grants to help cover the cost of the brace for the parents. There's a grant called United Healthcare Children's Foundation. And I think that's really important to let, I always let parents know that because I see a lot of parents getting reimbursed and because braces are expensive. So that's something I like to point out in the guide. And then I'll also have letters from other kids just of support that they've written that'll be on the website and coloring pages and just a lot of things like that. Just that book recommendations and shirt recommendations. And it's 19 pages, so it's a lot.
Yeah, and probably growing as you get more experience and learn more resources. And hopefully as more exposure to conditions like scoliosis increase, you start to see more resources grow in general, like more resources for it. So yeah, support guides like that are invaluable. I like to think that in the medical community, being a physician, that we provide everything that the patient needs, but we really don't. We provide the diagnosis, we provide hopefully, you know, good education to that diagnosis, treatment options, you know, a safe place to get your medical care and something to not be scared to come into the office and if you're having symptoms and whatnot. But the vast majority of living with something like scoliosis is going to happen outside the office. And so having someone like yourself and that support guide to send people to different websites or different communities to get their questions answered. And maybe most importantly, resources and websites of accurate, well-vetted, good people who are trying to do the right thing rather than the dark alleys of the internet that we sometimes can find ourselves in. So very, very good stuff there. We're going to talk a lot about screening in this episode. So I'm interviewing you, and there's going to be a lot more stuff with a colleague of mine and who's a scoliosis specialist in addition to my co-host, Dr. Bruni. And we're going to talk a lot about screening, trying to figure out, you know, should we be looking for this? And the United States Preventative Task Force service is, generally speaking, our go-to for whether we should be screening for certain things. They do a lot of the research and ultimately at this point actually determines whether things are going to be covered by insurance. Like you can get a colonoscopy covered at a certain age because that task force services has said that it is cost effective and appropriate. And so A and B recommendations are covered. So, but they currently state that there's insufficient evidence to recommend screening for everyone 10 to 18 years old. And just some background, you know, A and B, they say basically to do it. C is unknown. D is don't do it. And I means we don't know yet. So it doesn't mean don't do it. And it doesn't mean do it. It just means like there's not enough good data to tell us. And that's where scoliosis seems to fit for 10 to 18 year olds. Much of this is due to the tests not being very accurate, meaning like the screening test, not an x-ray, but like screening out in the community. And then long-term outcomes of finding the condition, meaning, okay, now you found somebody with it who doesn't have symptoms, being debatable. Meaning if you find a ton of kids who have scoliosis, how much difference are you making for the most of them? Because some of it's not going to need braces and such. So that was a very long-winded intro of saying, as someone with scoliosis and someone who interacts daily with others who have the condition, what are your perspectives on screening?
I think it's the most important thing. I don't understand that study, to be honest. Like the tests are non-invasive to screen for it. If there is an accuracy issue, you know, with the school nurse doing it, for example, they can be referred to the doctor. The doctor can then check and then, if necessary, x-rays to confirm. But it just makes such a big difference in the outcome for the kid to have an early diagnosis. I see so many kids that are 7, 8 years old, even my little nephew, he's 10 years old, and we think he has scoliosis. And if that school screening wouldn't have been done, in his case, I screened him, but if that wouldn't have been caught early, it could progress. And just, you know, like my case is the perfect example. It was caught early, but nothing was done about it. And if I had been braced when I was a kid, I could have not ended up needing surgery. So I think it's super important. I just think that, like I said, even if there is a 90% of them are accurate of the screening, like there's multiple follow-up steps that can be done. I just don't see the harm in screening for it. I think there's a lot greater good that can come from it.
Yeah, I really appreciate your input on that. I think having, you know, your perspective as somebody who's lived through the condition is obviously very important in that conversation. I feel like leading up to now, the screening that I've been most aware of is the screening that happened in schools. In a situation where the person who is doing that screening probably is not a world's expert in it, but it, you know, hopefully has done it before, there's probably a chance for false positives. You know, I think you may have scoliosis. You should get this checked out. Therefore, hopefully they go to a doctor and get it checked out. Do you think there's unintended consequences of things like that, like a false positive on a screen like that for a family?
I mean, there's going to be a little stress that causes, you know, like what is scoliosis? What is this going to mean? I think the greater benefit is more important. And one thing I would point out too, is that there, if you go to bracingforscoliosis.org, so us at the end instead of is, there's a lot of screening that parents can do just to monitor their kids. And there's just things they can look for as far as asymmetry in their waist and things like that. And there's really good graphics and it's so simple to do. So just, you know, have parents check for that every couple months. But yeah, I just think it's so important and it can get missed so much. Even at doctor's offices, they aren't always done in their yearly physical and things like that. So yeah, I just think screening is super important. And it's not even done in all schools in the U.S. and Canada completely canceled their school screening. So it's
a big deal. I side with you on this one. And I actually was going to ask you about what parents could do, because I do feel like parents see the ones I see in the office, definitely that it seems like the parent maybe notices first. Like it seems like you're off in some form or fashion. So I think that's a great resource and we'll make sure that that's linked. for people to be able to look at home. I mean, the parent knows the kid the best, generally speaking, and has usually seen the kid without a shirt on more than anybody else. And so in theory, that's a really good screening. But I'm with you, because I think the concept here is the screening test is non-invasive. It's basically bending forward and touching the ground is probably the most common one that's done. And then the testing to find out is an X-ray, which is very non-invasive, very low radiation, and one-time thing. And so, again, I think there is that added stress and concern, and the amount of time it takes to get into the doctor, you know, can delay that. There's co-pays. There's access problems. I mean, we need to be fixing all these things so that everybody can have access. People don't have to, you know, mortgage their house to get medical care. But ultimately speaking, I'm with you. I think that this is a pretty easy thing to screen for, and that the consequences of a false positive, at least at the screening test, is not terrible. So I think you have lived the experience and can give us the insight into, you know, finding out means something, and then finding the community of people with it is really, really helpful. So any comment on any of that before I move on?
Yeah. One thing I would add is that, like you mentioned, parents see their kids more than anyone, and perhaps without a shirt on more than anyone to notice it. But I find with so many parents that they always say, how did I miss this? Mm-hmm. How did I not see this? Like 99% of parents I talk to have this like mom guilt. Like, how did I not see this? And it's because their kids are at a time when their bodies are changing and all that. Like, they don't want their parents to see them without
a
shirt.
That's such a good point.
You know, like it'll get seen when they're in a bathing suit type of thing, but the parents don't see it. And so that's why the screening is so important. Like, sometimes parents pick up on it, but, you know, it's a hard thing to catch just by looking at somebody unless you're trained to know what to look for, you know?
God, that's such a good point, especially with that age. I'm thinking of, I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, but I'm just thinking about that. There's been a couple of times where my 6-year-old girl, she hasn't had a shirt on, and I was like, hey, just bend forward. And I like looked at her spine, just, I don't know, I'm a doctor and I just do that. But like my 6-year-old didn't really care that her shirt was off and that she was around me. And you're right. If she was a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old, she'd probably be like, Dad, get out of here. I don't want you anywhere near me. So, which I'm not looking forward to, but you're right. That's such a good point. You know, I think one of the things that we as medical providers don't get a great opportunity to ask, and a question I want to finish with you is, you know, what do you think that the medical field does well with scoliosis?
I think there's so much effort into improving outcomes to, you know, finding better ways to keep the curve from progressing. Like the medical side of it, I think is great. There's a lot of advancements in that. And I think there's a big push for advancements. I think the thing that's even, you know, not as a negative thing, but I think it's getting better is the emotional side. It's getting worked into doctor's appointments. You know, there's always room for improvement and more doctors that can do it. But I think a lot of doctors are starting to, you know, realize the emotional impact this has on kids. And like, for example, with my story, during the 2 years after I was in the car accident, I was just in so much pain, and we had gone to like 8 different surgeons all over the country. And I was just in such a depressed state, and all the doctors just said, you need more surgery, you need more surgery. But one doctor specifically had me fill out a questionnaire asking about my emotional, you know, state, you know, how I was doing. And I remember just that doctor saying, you know, just stay with us, Lauren, like, you can get through this. You know, he saw how much it was affecting me. And that really gave me the momentum to push through and to then be able to start Higgy Bears and do all this. So I think it's getting better. But I hope that continues, where doctors and orthotists continue to address the emotional aspect of it.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you correctly, when we are making this diagnosis or treating these patients, each time we are coming in contact with them, you feel like it would be important to also say, you know, how are you doing emotionally with this? How are you feeling?
Yeah.
Maybe even give a survey or a questionnaire where they can without having to answer the question directly, they can kind of say how they're feeling. Is that?
Yeah. And I mean, maybe not at every appointment, but, you know, to just check in with them and then to, you know, scoliosis, they do a great job of, that's their biggest focus, is getting the support to the kids and getting that in the hands of doctors, their brochure to share the information. So, you know, I mean, I know there's a limited time that doctors have with patients, so I totally get it. But, yeah, maybe just doing a little questionnaire. I don't think it can hurt. And I think it's important for the patient to know that the doctor is not only concerned with their curvature, but also concerned with their mental health, which is so important.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Now everybody's favorite question. What can we do better? What do we stink at? Like what would you say that the doctors in the medical field just really miss out when it comes to scoliosis, outside of the fact that you were clearly given wrong advice when you were younger? We could do a better job of not missing the diagnosis and giving people better treatment recommendations, which I do think we do better today. But
yeah, I don't know. I mean, nothing comes to mind, really. I think that, you know, especially considering where I was a long time ago, I think things have gotten so much better. I don't think there's anything that doctors do poorly when it comes to scoliosis. I mean, there's always the occasional complaint I get from parents that, you know, a doctor or surgeon had horrible bedside manner, you know, but that can be with anything, I guess. I don't think there's anything in particular that's not good.
I'm glad we have that on record. I will make sure that we, and in addition, yes, if you're listening, physicians, you could sometimes be nicer and more caring.
There you go.
That's the feedback. Okay, so with your organization, Higgy Bears, you make these awesome bears, and again, we'll have the website. Everybody needs to go to the website and look at these awesome things. I mean, I know how much my kids are addicted to stuffed animals, and they don't have scoliosis or a brace, so I can only imagine how addicted they would be to these if they did have scoliosis, because the bears are just super cute. How many bears do you think you've made to date or put out there?
I have made between 25,000 and 30,000.
Oh my goodness. Point.
Yeah, and they're in over 150 countries at last count, so they're all over the world, and it's just so many people that I've been able to affect, and it's all because of what I did go through, because if I didn't and I had surgery and I was fine, you know, I would have just gone back to work and none of this would have happened, so I just feel really blessed to do this, but yeah, about almost 30,000 at this point.
That's crazy. That's amazing. Everything seems to keep coming back to my own children here, but I do know that if you offered them 30,000 stuffies individually, they would take it. These are each person is getting one stuffy, so that is 25,000 to 30,000 people with one bear. That's crazy. Do you make them yourself?
Not the stuffed animals themselves, but the little boxes. I have been making them up until about 2 months ago. I got my brother-in-law involved, and he has the Higgy Bear Workshop at his house, so him and my sister physically make the braces now, and I just kind of run everything. But yeah.
Wow. Good for you. That's fantastic. Well, I think that's all the questions I have, Lauren. Is there anything else you wanted to get out there?
I have HiggyCon coming up, which is for kids. It's like 3 days of just fun, just a big party for kids with scoliosis and their parents. It's going to be in Rosemont, Illinois.
Oh, right, it's by us.
Yeah, there you go. You'll have to come. It's super fun. But that makes a huge difference, because the Zooms are awesome, but like seeing kids in person and just getting to be a kid and play and laugh, and it's life-changing for a lot of families.
Cool. Very cool. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
What you're doing is fantastic. I do know that anybody that I diagnose with scoliosis in the near future will be going to the Higgy Bear website for sure.
Awesome. And just let people know too that Higgy Bears are free now. So like parents just pay shipping, which is huge. So many more people can get them. And I really, really appreciate you bringing awareness to this, and just not even just Higgy Bears, but just scoliosis in general. Like it was very, like I've done interviews with scoliosis podcasts and things like that, but it was really refreshing to get interviewed by like a general health podcast that they're focused on this. So it's really important, and I really appreciate it.
So that's pretty awesome stuff, right, Julie? Kind of like we had with the colorectal cancer people, and just hearing their perspectives both, you know, and again, in this case, Lauren was a patient herself, and in the previous episodes, they had family members with it, and just hearing their experiences and what they go through and what they learn just teaches me so much.
Absolutely. And I think we've brought this up so many times, especially when we have people share their personal stories, whether it's our colorectal cancer advocates or Liz O'Riordan or your patient with the back pain that ended up having coronary disease. There's so many different ways in which representation matters. And representation matters by, it's very helpful for people to see themselves represented either in the media or in places of power or in education or, you know, to look up to and have someone who has had a similar lived experience to them and watch them model behavior that is validating and is inspiring. And representation matters in so many different ways, and we've talked about it in a lot of different ways on this podcast. And here's another real world in motion example of representation mattering and how someone's lived experience has now created a ripple effect where they're helping and advocating other people to improve their journey through that similar experience too. And I just find it really cool and really inspiring. And it's one of those cool, you know, human interest pieces that usually gets put on the news, but we could do as many of those as we want because it's our podcast.
I think what I took away from doing this episode, I mean, first of all, I think that the screening at this point is pretty inconsistent. I think there's 34 states that still require it when they're young, and certainly that probably changes on a regular basis and is probably not well publicized. So I don't think there's a lot of people who would even know whether their school districts are still doing this or not unless they get a phone call and says, I think your kid may have scoliosis. So I think I'm going to be a little bit more assertive in my screening for scoliosis. You know, I certainly think I'm going to, you know, maybe watch my kids a little closer or certainly younger kids who come into the office who have, you know, upper extremity complaints. I may be a little bit more assertive with having them remove, clothing and put them in gowns just to make sure that I'm doing a good job of looking for this. But honestly, I think the thing that I'm most thankful for from this episode was having Lauren tell me about some resources to direct parents and kids other than like medical sites or society sites that are certainly factual and good, but are sometimes unapproachable and generally don't address the psychosocial aspects of the diagnosis. And I think a lot of times we send people home with what we think is important information, and I don't want to undermine it, but it's, you know, this is the diagnosis. I'm probably going to refer you to see a specialist. The patient that I mentioned to you at the beginning is seeing Dr. DeWald. And I think that's important. I think understanding, you know, here's a reference if you want to learn more about it. Here's the next treatment plan. These are all good things. But when they go home, I think a lot of times the psychosocial is maybe the thing that's loudest in the brain. Like, how am I going to live with this? Are there other people that have it? Am I abnormal? Should I have other family members screened for it? Like very normal questions. And so being able to hand somebody something to the effect of, yeah, just go to this Higgy Bears website. They have a huge manual, 19-page manual of resources they've put together that can kind of help you through this, I think is maybe the most powerful thing I gained from it.
Yeah, we love actionable items and empowering actionable items on this show, and we love highlighting people that share those values too. And it's, yeah, give us the roadmap. It's really great, especially when you're confronted with any type of medical diagnosis is going to be scary. So it's great. Lauren's doing a wonderful, wonderful job. And again, big ripple effects. I think it's great.
So if you enjoyed the episode, again, please leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening. I can't overstate how helpful that is for this podcast to be able to keep going and honestly keep everything free and not have to have sponsors and do all that stuff. It really comes down to getting 5-star reviews and having you spread the word. So we appreciate our YDF listeners and community. And if you could just take the couple seconds to do that, it's really, really helpful. If you leave us a comment or something in the reviews, we will read that too. But certainly the 5-star part is really, really helpful. So, Julie, you may be met with twists and turns in life and in your spine. Either way, we're here for you. Listen to your doctor friends.
The amazing music is credited to SkillCell with Pixabay licensure. The podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast should not be taken as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Please consult a medical professional for any medical issues that you may be having. The contents of this podcast are the opinions of the hosts only and do not reflect the opinions of their employers or affiliations. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Under no circumstances shall Dr. Julie Bruni or Dr. Jeremy Allen or any guest to the podcast be responsible for damages arising from use of the podcast.